City of Beaky Blinders, Birmingham, England. I would like to introduce you to Paddy Danda.
Hi there. Welcome to the Beaky Agilist podcast, where I get curious about all things agile. Simply put, agile is about responding to change as quickly as possible, which can be pretty useful in today's fast-paced world. In each episode, I'll be inviting authors, thought leaders, and a few friends to share their stories and insights in everyday language that even I can understand. So sit back, grab a samosa or two, and enjoy. I'm joined by someone who has a bunch of superpowers that have helped him become the author of two best-selling books on sketchnoting, the Sketchnote Handbook and the Sketchnote Workbook. He's the illustrator of the New York Times bestsellers, Rework and Remote, as well as others. He's a teacher, speaker, podcaster, and most importantly, a father. And he also loves a bit of curry, which is a topic close to my heart. So I'd love to welcome the amazing Mike Rohde. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paddy, nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome, Mike. You're welcome. So I wanted to kick off by remembering a legend, the late Sir Ken Robinson, who passed away earlier this week. He's most famous for his TED talk on Do Schools Kill Creativity? And it's, I believe, the most popular TED talk of all time. Mike, did you want to share any thoughts on the fantastic work that he did to raise awareness on the importance of creativity within education?
I would love to. I don't know a lot about Ken, other than obviously the TED talk that I've seen was highly influenced by it, seen it many times. And the funny story that you asked me about that talk, and the thing I remember is the talk about the little girl who was having trouble in school, and there was someone who was willing to think outside of the check boxes on the piece of paper that the school gave them and said, why don't we, let's put a radio in a room and leave her be and see what happens. So there was someone creative enough to do that. And it turned out that this little girl was motivated by music and moving her body. Turns out she turned into an amazing dancer because someone was willing to look beyond, you know, the strict description of what a child should be and look more toward what her passion was or what her interests were and sort of built around her. So I've always been really impressed by that story, and it rings in my head with my own kids a lot of times when, you know, I want them to do certain things and I remember that, you know, there's some things that am I really just holding on to things because they're important to me, or is it actually beneficial to my kids? And that's a tough one to put yourself under, but it's also a good one because it reminds me that not everything is about making me convenient or fitting my way of thinking, but that there's many times that I need to be more adaptable.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic, Mike. And I remember when I first showed that talk to my daughter, who's 11, and a sort of day or so later, I asked her, I said, what did you actually remember from that talk? And that's the exact story that she mentioned. Yeah. It just goes to show, I think, also that talk itself has been, it's almost like a masterclass for public speaking. A lot of people do go back to that talk to get some ideas and inspiration. So yeah, it's phenomenal in so many different ways. So thank you for sharing that. So visual thinking and visual facilitation, sketchnoting, these are all terms that are sort of used for visualization. And someone who isn't so familiar with sort of visualization, they probably feel a little bit confused. So could you explain the differences between some of those terms?
Sure. Well, I think in general, we're all built to do visualization. I mean, if you look at the way the brain is built and the way we're designed to take in information with our eyes, the way we're designed to process information with our brains, how good we are at recognizing patterns and gaps and things that are out of place, if we focus ourselves, that we're actually built for that visualization. But I think a lot of times what I've seen, at least in my experience of teaching basic visualization class in the form of sketchnoting, teaching basic sketchnoting, is many people have stopped drawing when they're probably about your daughter's age, right? 11, 12, 13, somewhere in those years. Maybe they last a little bit longer, but many people stop drawing at that point. And so when I come into a classroom, or I'm online in a classroom now, there's lots of trepidation. It's almost as scary as public speaking for some people. And I've sort of tried to think about why is that true. And I think what I realized was, and this is my theory, is you might be a very accomplished person. Say you're a CEO of a company or a very well established person in a certain role, right? There's expectations and you have sort of an image, right, that you're trying to maintain. And if you draw like you're 12 years old, that does not fit the image that you're trying to portray. So suddenly that becomes a liability. You can't show that. And there's fear about that. And there's probably fear too, even beyond that, the brand awareness, if you want to call it that, or image consciousness, the feeling that you're out of control, right? So you're, let's again go back to an accomplished person, someone who's, you know, an adult who's made their way through life, and now they come face to face with this thing that they're not very good at, right? It's that can be really scary to be asked to draw something and you don't know even where to begin. That is something that I realized early on when I wrote the first book, the Sketchnote Handbook, and actually before that had been brewing. And so I realized if I didn't solve this problem, I wouldn't sell very many books. So the solution for me was to break drawing down in a little different way. What I discovered was when I did sketchnoting, I was actually using a few sets of symbols, almost, I call them like Lego pieces. Right. And I ended up calling those the five basic elements. So they're square, circle, triangle, line, and dot. There's some visual thinking teachers that have more than me, which is fine. Basically I wanted it to be rememberable. So if you've got five images like that, you know, you it's easy to remember. It's the, isn't that the Dunbar number, five plus or minus two. So, I mean, you're in that window that you could remember those five things. If you have 12, you know, you might get to about seven and you'd forget the rest. So I didn't want to overload someone, but beyond that, it was the idea that you could take five simple shapes and it gave you a framework with which you could build things. It made it a lot simpler and more approachable. It was a little different approach than what I learned in my design school class when I did drawing, which was observation, right? You're looking at something like a vase or a person and you're observing and drawing and you're sort of doing it that way, right? There's lots of emphasis on seeing an object. Well, if you have ideas or metaphors in your head, it's pretty difficult to draw those things if you're not looking at something. So you have to think of a different way to express those. If by providing these five elements and showing how they can be put together in simple ways, it sort of it changes your framework by which you think of ideas. So it's a way of expressing ideas, almost like using letters in an alphabet. It's just a much simpler alphabet, and you know, you can build and stretch these objects, right? So square is a rectangle, a circle is an oval, a line can be wiggly, right? So you can sort of extend this concept out there. And that I think is what has broken through in my experience when I go into rooms of people that have that fear, by offering them a safe, first of all, a safe space where they can operate, and it's okay to be someone who doesn't have drawing as a powerful skill, that everybody else in the room is in a similar place. That certainly helps. A lot of that falls on me as a facilitator of the space to make sure people feel safe and that they would never be called out or made fun of for their ability to draw. And then secondly, giving them a tool, a practical tool they can actually apply that very moment so that they can actually move beyond this fear and start to build a little tiny bit of confidence. And the fascinating thing is I've run the 1 hour version, which is part of all my teaching, probably hundreds of times. And every time I get done, there's people that walked in and raised their hand and said, I can't draw. And then by the end, they can. They feel like they can. That is a huge confidence builder. And that's the foundation for everything else. Now, of course, once you realize you can do that, then it comes down to practice and application, which is a different story.
Right, right. No, absolutely. And I think I absolutely hear you on that one. It's a bit like my writing. My writing is appalling. And I'm pretty sure if I was in a room full of people, I'd be sort of hiding that away, and I guess I can see the equivalent with, especially with drawing, you know, for many people that aren't used to that, that way of working, they perhaps would take a similar approach. And then I guess, Mike, so in terms of the differences between visual facilitation, sketchnoting, visual thinking, in terms of this different terminology, what do all these things mean?
Well, that's the way I would describe it is I would first start by saying visual thinking is a broad category in my view. It sort of encompasses everything that you might have mentioned there. So I think of, so something can be visual thinking, but visual thinking isn't necessarily that other thing. So let's take an example, sketchnoting, we'll start there. Mm-hmm. So for me, sketchnoting typically is small scale. It's using words and pictures together. It's something you're drawing by hand, whether that's on an iPad or a piece of paper. And it's something that you're doing with your own perspective, like you're doing it for yourself. It's infused with your personality and your thinking. You're not necessarily trying to be objective as a starting point. So that would be sketchnoting. So sketchnoting is visual thinking, but visual thinking isn't as like, you know, is bigger than sketchnoting in that sense. I would say then, I came up with this term sketchnoting many years ago because it solved the problem for me. And it seemed like the right name and it seems to have stuck, right? So I'm really happy about that. It turned out later on as I worked through this that there was a whole category of work that was really similar in principle called graphic facilitation or graphic recording. So graphic recording was started back in the 70s out in California by a guy named David Sibbett and a variety of other characters who pushed this idea of visualization of solving business problems and other visualization uses, right? Typically more practical in business. And it had really similar principles, listening, analyzing, visualizing, using words and pictures to capture these ideas. Now, graphic recording typically is done on large boards. You might often, if you think about it, this might be your experience to go to an event and see somebody at the front of the room when someone's speaking and over to the right or to the left. There's a big sheet of foam board of some kind, and they're basically drawing live with markers on that board. Yeah. Now there's sort of a move with Corona for a lot of these graphic facilitators have been forced to move to iPads or other devices, Surface Pros, to do this virtually because there is no front of the room anymore, right? So in some ways, it's probably a good revolution for this industry because it's forcing some of the old school paper and pen people to sort of shift and actually expand their services. So that would be graphic recording. And I think the difference between the sketchnoting and graphic recording is typically graphic recording is done by a professional, somebody who's trained in this work. They are taught to be neutral, almost like a reporter for a newspaper or, well, maybe not necessarily, but you know, the ideal is to be as neutral as possible, not to insert your opinions. Of course, the scale, you know, at least until we get to doing it on an iPad, right? Scale was an important difference. And that's quite a big difference, especially if you're a graphic recorder and you do sketchnoting, it can be quite a jarring shift to do such a small scale, and the same going the other direction. So that I would think are the main differences, but I think principally the core concepts are really similar. And then you have a term like graphic facilitation, which from my perspective is someone who is doing graphic using flow charts and templates and drawing live, but also facilitating a meeting, which to me seems like really difficult work, right? To facilitate a meeting and to draw at the same time, that's like another level up from there, right? So it takes definite training and skill and mastery to do that. Another term you might have heard is mind mapping. So mind mapping was created by a guy named Tony Buzan, who uses this idea of sort of a center point or a center concept and then branching off of it to show, you know, let your mind wander and explore ideas. So that's another popular term that you might see. And then visual note-taking, I would say that's just a neutralized term of sketchnoting or another way to say sketchnoting, same kind of thing. Those are the big ones that I can think of. Are there other ones that you have heard that maybe you would like to have defined?
Yeah, no, I think that sort of covers it absolutely. I think I've been hearing these stuff. It's a bit like if I think about my role as an agile coach, people often get confused by agile, Scrum, Kanban. Like, what are all of these things? How do they all link together? How does Lean link into this? So, yeah. I think with visualization, that's probably the closest I can think of in terms of terminology that might be a little bit confusing for people.
Yeah, I mean, if you did the corollary with Agile, I mean, Agile is, Scrum is Agile, but Agile is not necessarily Scrum. Scrum is one flavor, right, that exists. Yeah. Kanban is another flavor. There's probably many others that I can't think of at the moment. And I've worked in a variety of these, so I've seen them from the inside. And I like them. I like the iterative nature and the way that these, they work a lot like a designer works, which is what I am. So right. They seem to fit my way of working really well. I think probably the danger that I can see in Agile, sometimes it can get very religious. So you follow the rule of the law, mm-hmm. but you lose the spirit of the law, right? That can also happen in, I think it can also happen in visual thinking too, right? Where you can start having, you know, wars about words and what they mean instead of remembering that it's the visualization that's important. In that right. necessarily terms.
Awesome. So hold that thought, Mike, because I'm going to come back to that towards the end. Okay. I think that will be a really good talking point. Is some of your concerns about the industry, but we'll park that one. So maybe let's talk a little bit about Agile and perhaps how you've used your visual skills in that environment of perhaps Agile or design thinking, you know, some of these specialisms that you've been involved in, because I'm sure there's lots of people out there who are working in that space. They sort of are intrigued by this sort of sketchnoting term and the creativity that goes behind it. But practically, how do they then use that in their day-to-day work?
That's a really good question. I think I suggest always looking for small ways to integrate it. So when we still had offices and whiteboards, having a whiteboard session with someone where you actually draw out your thinking, I think is a really great way to use these skills. In my specific work, because I'm really pushing these concepts, sketchnoting and visual thinking in general, I tended to use them all the time in the work that I did. So in a previous engagement that I had some years ago at a financial services company, over time, working inside an Agile team, we realized that there could be real value in having team visual thinking sessions. And the way that they were framed was our team was tasked with rebuilding an old piece of software that was Windows-based, but to build it as a web tool. So there was bunch of benefits that come with that, right? So there was a tool that existed, and many of the things that we were replicating, that tool did. But in some cases, it got bound into the Windows way of doing things, or just not really efficient, not very user-friendly ways of doing things. So anytime a feature would come up, we would look at it and say, is it useful the way it is, or could it be extended or improved? And we would have these sessions eventually on Mondays where myself and the business analysts and developers and product owners would all sit around this large table. We had a giant wall-sized whiteboard. Typically, I was doing graphic facilitation in that case. And I would typically have two colors, maybe a black and then a red or something like that. And as we talked about features, I would actually listen to what they were saying and draw those features on the whiteboard. And as they would make comments about it, then I would use the red to make notes and to annotate what it was that was being drawn on the board. And sort of bouncing ideas off of the people in the room. So like asking them, is this what you're talking about? Did I get it right? Are there any other details that I'm missing that need to be added? Right. So all those kind of questions, I would sort of pull it out of the group and then produce it on this whiteboard. We developed this specifically because I was one designer on a team of about 50, a mix of a bunch of developers and product owners and a few BAs. Right. So I was outnumbered in this situation. So I immediately saw the problem with me being the one designer on the team was that I was going to be a bottleneck if I wasn't careful. So I had to devise a way to at least alleviate the bottleneck as much as I could. So part of the reason we did this session was simply that we could talk through these solutions, and we would often go through 5-6 different ideas for the same problem, same feature. And I would document all of it and we would annotate it. And then typically I would push the team as a facilitator to pick one. What's the one that we like the best? Why do we like this the best? You know, we'd talk about pros and cons, and we would say, well, you know, number three, that's probably my first choice, and number five, that's my second choice. So I would circle those two and put a star or something. And at the end of the session, we would take a photo and then put that in a shared drive so that all of the team could get access to it. Typically, there was many smaller teams that we would rotate through them, so they would have their own boards. And the idea being that if there is a common place, so let's say they pulled a ticket and they were ready to work on that feature, they could pull the whiteboard session they were in with their product owner, with the BA. All that knowledge was now captured on the board. They can then take that whiteboard and start to build and code what we imagined together. And then at some point they would call me over and say, hey, Mike, I built this feature. Come and take a look at it. What do you think about it from a usability perspective? Is there anything that can be improved? A lot of times the idea that we came up with on the board was a spark towards a better idea that they would come up with, because as a developer, they were much better at understanding all the possible ways to approach a problem. So they would often come back and say, you know, in the session, we actually thought this would be a good idea, but this modification actually makes it easier. Like the coding time would be a lot faster, and yet it still achieves a really similar outcome. Does it work for you? And so then we would work together. And that did two things. It allowed me to be freed up to not always be involved in building everything as a mock-up in Photoshop or Sketch. But it also, I think, it taught the developers how to think like designers, right? They were part of the ideation process. They could often initiate the process of development, thinking about it from a design perspective. And over time, as I would show them and explain to them why do we do this from a user experience perspective, they started to build skills as a user experience developer to understand those principles and why we do things the way we do. And we slowly built a language around our approach towards software development, which I think they really enjoyed. You know, so many developers I know get frustrated when they get something thrown over the wall at them and they just have to come up with something that may not be real practical, right? So being part of the process from the beginning and having the autonomy to sort of change up the calls as things rolled along based on reality really empowered the developers. And then they were also gaining knowledge around, you know, user experience, which a big part of that is the visual thinking part of it. So that was a really fun experience that I had, and I just really remembered that being beneficial for everybody. It was a real win-win all the way across the board. Everybody felt part of it, and if you looked at features that we designed together, you could not say that Mike or John or Joe or Mary designed it. It was all of us as a team that really came up with those concepts.
So I guess what I'm getting from you there is sort of the level of collaboration across that team.
Yes.
Really, really increased, right? So that's phenomenal. And I guess in terms of then as developers, they're actually building up an extra skill set, which they probably would never have had the opportunity otherwise.
Right. And that's just one example. I mean, there's other examples too, where, you know, I've taught it I'm on a current team. I've taught sketchnoting and encourage those people I sort of like using sketchnoting as an in-between process. Like, so that was a little bit of an in-between process, right? Like, we're not going to deliver photos of whiteboards to the client. They could care less about what we did on a whiteboard. They care about software that works, right? That's what the Agile team needs. That's what the customer needs, the owner needs. So how we get to that is up to us. In the same way, I think there can be places where you have ideas that you need to sort of sketch out. And I would say, don't hesitate to get a sheet of paper and a pen or pencil and just map those ideas out on the sheet and sort of explore what the relationships are and visualize them, even if it's really rough and not complicated, because ultimately you may be writing an email or producing a PowerPoint or coding something, right? Having this intermediate space where you can visualize your ideas and not be bound by software, I think is super valuable. So much of our lives is bound by the software that we use. And I think what people forget is when you use someone else's software, you're sort of following their opinion or their approach towards how that software works. You're by nature of using that software, submitting yourself to their vision, right? When you use a piece of paper and a pen, there are no constraints really other than your imagination. And it sort of changes the way you think about problems and gives you a little more freedom, I think, to work within. So I encourage people, just as a personal thing, to solve problems that way, to get a piece of paper out and sketch it, or have a notebook that you manage your day with. You know, maybe you reserve some pages where you can do that visualization, and then you've got a record of it that you can point back to.
Yeah, no, oh, that's great advice. Thank you, Mike. So now I'm going to take you a little bit back in time. So we're going to go back in time. So we're going to go back to when you were a young Mike Rohde. Not that you're old now, you know, still 21, Mike. But that time when perhaps, you know, you were in high school, and I just have this vision of you being like this rock star that all the other kids were like, hey, I want to hang out with Mike because he's just like this rock star when it comes to sketching. but you know, you sort of having these creative skills, you know, back then. So can you paint a picture, using words, of course, of what life was like for you back then? And you know, and when did you actually realize you had this creative side to you?
Well, I think I was really fortunate that through all my school years into my adulthood, I've been able to maintain drawing. I don't know if it's because I'm stubborn or lucky or a combination of both, but I've been drawing since I was very small. It was something that kept me busy. As a small boy, I would make my own newspapers and comic books and posters. I have a story when I was probably about 10 years old. I lived in a basement apartment in Chicago. And the interesting thing about this apartment was the windows were at the top of the wall, right? Because we're in the basement apartment. And so we had a pretty good window in my room, and I would do these drawings of race cars and whatever. I can't even remember everything that I did. And I would post those in the window, and kids in the neighborhood would come and buy them for a nickel or a dime or whatever. And so I was doing this work even at that point. But when I got into high school, I just sort of ended up finding opportunities to work. So I worked for the school newspaper. And in high school, you know, back then there wasn't lots of technology. There wasn't any really. So they would come to me near production time, probably like they were going to go to press in the afternoon. In the morning, they would come to me and say, okay, we laid out this article, and it was all manual, right? It was typing, you know, typeset letters and stuck on a board and stuff. They would come to me and say, we've got this hole. The article ran short, and we've got a hole. It's about an inch wide by 3 inches tall. Can you read the article and do a sketch, and we can put it in there to kind of fill the space? Like, okay. So I would read through the article and come up with some kind of a funny or interesting drawing and, you know, draw it to fit and stick it in there, and they would take it away and it would appear in the newspaper. I was actually very shy as a kid, and a little bit nerdy. Like, I was definitely not one of the popular kids. But I had my group of friends, and
that makes two of us, Mike, by the way.
Yeah, good. Nerds unite, you know? And so I was a printing nerd. So I was in the printing department in the school that I had. Our schools in Milwaukee tended to have like a couple of specialties in each high school. So I think our school was heating, ventilation, and air conditioning, and printing were our two specialties. So kids could actually get a leg up on those two industries. So I actually wanted to go into art, but when I, you know, I'd moved from another place, so I had to take this printing, but I found it really kind of fun because it was practical, and yet I could still use these artistic skills. So I would do posters. I had a little, when I was in high school, I had a little business card company that I ran. So we had letterpress, which is this really old school way of pressing letters on paper with ink to produce whatever printing. And so they had these old presses that were probably, I don't know, 60, 70 years old that were still running. And I would set them up, and I would sell kids on buying business cards, and I would charge them. And then I would go set up the press and run these business cards for them. So I was always sort of like looking for opportunities to express this artistic vision that I had. And so it was just kind of a fun time. I did lots of drawing and visualization, but I was definitely not the popular kid, that's for sure.
Still a rock star though, still a rock star. Super. So I guess then, as you sort of grew up, you know, who was your sort of almost idols or people that you looked up to, people that influenced your journey, you know, into where you ended up?
Well, it's probably a mix of people. One, of course, are my parents, my mom and my dad, which are very different personalities. My mother was very artistic, so she always encouraged me to do drawing. And my dad was very practical. Like, he was good at solving problems. Well, he still is, as well as my mom, but less so because I'm, you know, independent now. But the one thing about my dad was, and I think this is a precursor to working with developers and system thinkers and people that work this way, he was very practical, and he could solve almost any problem physically. But often I would have a different perspective than him. So we came up with some really unique solutions. Like, if we were fixing the car or doing work on the house, I could imagine these really strange solutions to the problem, and then he could actually deliver it, right? He had the technical skills to know how to deliver it. So we made a really good team. So that was really influential. I would say there were also some people that did work that I was really influenced by. So in my time, Daredevil, the comic book, was really popular. It was a guy named Frank Miller who did that work, who ultimately went on to do movies and a bunch of other stuff. But his style was just so jarring for me as a kid when I would buy these Daredevil comics. Like, the way he would lay out the panels and his style, this bold, really strong style. Like the combination of all those things, just like no other comic looked like Frank Miller. And it was really influential, I think, on my illustration style as I look back. The way he would use perspective and those kind of things was really unique at the time. So he was definitely an influence in the work that I did. So, and then as I got into college, I was really a fan of lots of design leaders. So Massimo Vignelli and many other designers who were doing really groundbreaking design work, print design work at the time, were really influential. I somehow got copies of the books, and there was no internet at the time. So it was lots of magazine reading and looking for samples and trying to replicate those guys. They were really influential as well.
Oh, fantastic. And I guess, Mike, if you were, say if you were born in today's world with all the digital sort of disruption that we have around us, do you think sketchnoting would be better or worse for it?
Well, I mean, it only came about in, 2007. So that's not, I guess, that terribly long ago, 13 years ago, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it did come about in the internet era. I think I was actually doing it a lot longer. And it's one of the funny comments that people, when they discover sketchnoting, will say, I've been doing this for years. I just never had a name for it. And they're really excited that there's a name and there's sort of a movement around this name. So I think in some ways it was born of the internet age, but I think what you're maybe pointing out is that the iPad, at least in its current incarnation, didn't really exist. If you wanted to use something digital, you'd have to use like a Wacom, like a Cintiq or some other tool with an expensive computer and Photoshop, and it was cumbersome, and these tools had giant cables to plug into your, it wasn't very portable. So, it was limited to like people with the funds and the need to have those tools, right?
Yeah.
Your option is really paper, notebooks and pens. So I think I'm actually happy that it happened this way, right? Because I think I view analog and digital tools as a spectrum on which I can work, right? So I can do something in analog or I can do something in digital. They each have their advantages and disadvantages. And each project sort of calls for, not always, but many times, like certain technologies serve it better, right? So if you're gonna go into the bush for a long period of time, right? And you need to do like a sketchnoting of a natural phenomenon, let's say for 3 months, like you may not wanna take an iPad Pro because it might, you're always gonna have to worry about charging it and damaging it. And you might be better off with a tough notebook or a bag that could hold it, right? So that's what I mean by that. But on the other hand, if you're doing work that's requires quick turnaround and you need to, they say, post to social media, you could certainly do that with pen and paper, but you have limits in your ability to modify and change. And that's where an iPad may be actually a better solution. So it provides like a really wide spectrum of options, but that you can choose the one that works best for you. So I'm kind of glad that it happened in more of an analog way at first, because by the time the digital tools came along, it was pretty well established, and it was really an extension of the principles that the digital provided instead of being driven by digital. That's really interesting. It would have been interesting if the iPad Pro had existed before sketchnoting had come along, how that would have influenced. I'm not sure I could imagine that, but maybe there would be a lot more people using digital tools. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting. And I guess those people out there that are thinking of taking their sketchnoting seriously and to kind of the next level, would you have any advice for them in terms of spending, a certain amount of time learning the digital side versus the more analog side? Would you say it's entirely up to you, whatever you prefer?
I think the principles, like I mentioned, are pretty consistent across. It's really the how you deliver, I guess.
Yeah.
So there could be benefits to having the iPad. So I mean, the funny thing about the iPad is, you're spending $1,000. Like, how many pens and paper could you buy for that? Probably a lifetime supply, right? Like, and as good as the iPad is, like, it's still not exactly perfect. Like, there's limitations. There's things that don't feel exactly right. Like, if you zoom up an iPad sketch, at a certain point, you see the pixels, right? Unless you're using a vector tool, but the vector tool doesn't exactly represent ink exactly right. So it's not exactly perfect either, right? So it's an approximation And then, of course, there's the care and feeding of this object that you now have to take care of. And then, you know, worry about breaking it and battery life and all those things surrounding it. But I think for a professional, having this skill, I think, I mean, especially now, like there's so much happening online. There's certainly ways that you can use a camera to project your analog stuff. But there's just so many advantages, especially if you're a professional. If you're an amateur who is curious about it, you know, if you have an iPad and you want to try and use it in this way, I think it can be fun to try it. But as a professional, you may just find that this tool is really indispensable to have just to give you more options, right? Mm-hmm. If you can do it a little bit faster and a little more quickly and make a little more on the project that you're doing, that could be worth the investment.
No, absolutely. And I guess a common question that I've often had on sort of social media from people is, you know, what software app would you recommend? Like, what are your go-to apps? Because I think that'll be really, really interesting to hear from you.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of a tool called Paper by WeTransfer. It's free. There is a paid version that's, I think it's like $12 a year. When you add it up, it adds a few features that pros like me appreciate. But I think all of the tools, I have to think about Procreate. If Procreate's another tool, really fantastic tool. I think they have a free version and an in-app purchase upgrade. And these tend to be iPad specific. There's another tool called Concepts, which I think they support Android, Windows, and as well as iPad. So that's another one. That one uses vectors. So that's interesting because your drawings can scale up and down. So if you are more of an illustrator, you could use that feature more effectively. That could be the way you can go. But I mean, all these tools are really inexpensive. I think Procreate is like less than $10. I mean, for what that tool is, it's kind of amazing. I don't know how they support their business model with that price, but they must have so many users that it works out somehow. So I mean, even if even if you're an amateur and you just want to try these things, like there's a few dollars you can spend and have a pretty decent tool. I mean, even if you use an iPad, Apple's Notes tool is improving, right? So the ability it has, if you didn't want to use something that you have to pay for that's already included, you've got that right there. And then, of course, there's note-taking tools like GoodNotes, and even Microsoft OneNote supports the Apple Pencil. So there's all kinds of tools out there. I think a lot of it is trying them out and seeing which one fits your style and personality, because I think it is definitely a style question, how you interact with it and what fits your needs. So those are a couple that I can mention, but there may be others that I'm not aware of that are just fine and maybe they fit you better.
Sure. No, absolutely. And I know on the analog front, you've launched your own sketchbook from what I've seen.
Yeah. So this is called the Sketchnote Idea Book. I've got a sample I can throw up right here. So
oh yeah. Awesome.
I'm not sort of working in the background, but I'll see if I can get it to pop up.
Yeah, there you go. We can see it. Oh, yeah.
So basically, I'd used notebooks for a long time, and there were things about notebooks that I liked and things that bugged me. And so what I did is I took all the things I liked and I included them. And the things that bugged me, I tried to find solutions to counteract those things that bothered me. So one thing I didn't like was the cover of notebooks over time would sort of get damaged and come apart. So our Sketchnote Idea Book has a polymer cover, so it's pretty tough and it feels really nice. So it's almost like a stress reliever, right? The other thing that I think is at the core was the paper had to be really, really good. It had to be thick enough to hold ink and not bleed. So for most inks, this paper works really well. If you use something like alcohol based inks, like a Sharpie or a Copic marker, at some point that alcohol is going to penetrate because its job is to penetrate paper. And if you keep laying it on there, it's eventually going to go through. The only paper that doesn't do that with markers of those kind is marker paper designed for that kind of marker. So that was really important. We had it lay flat, so you could lay it flat. It's good for left-handers. And then there's guides inside. So if you're beginning Sketchnote or even an advanced Sketchnote, there's guides that you can refer to and remember some of the details. And so it's just a combination of those really basic foundational things. And the Kickstarter went really well. I think we went 400% over our goal, and we're now selling them directly from Airship Notebooks for those who are interested.
Oh, fantastic. We'll post a link in the sort of podcast description so that folks can go to that if they're interested.
Yeah. We're getting really good feedback from users. They're really happy with all the, I think it's like, I always think of products have to have a good balance of everything. Like sometimes, you know, product designers will make one part really strong and sort of skimp on another part. And I think I see value in tools that are well balanced. Like they may be really good in some areas, but they have enough support in other areas to hold their own. Mm. So I think we sort of aim for that. And I think the balance of all the parts really makes the notebook work well.
Awesome. So, and just one final question on the sort of recommendations on the materials in terms of pen. Like I know when you're sketchnoting, you're using sort of fine liners, but is there any tips and recommendations on that?
I'm a big fan of gel pens, and there's such a variety now. Lately, Sharpie just released a gel pen, which I picked up, and I can show you the one I have here, which is a 1.0 gel. I don't know if it will show, but brand new pen. It's got a really thick point. I've found that I can pull the innards out and put it into other pens, actually, so that's kind of nice. There's a Pilot G2, and Uniball makes them. So those are a good starting place. What I like about those kind of pens is you can go into any corner grocery store and find them,
right,
or into an office supply store. It's not necessarily a fancy tool. So if yours runs out and you're on the road or something, it's not hard to just run up to the convenience store and find another one, probably just like it, right? So that's an advantage. I am an ambassador for another company out of Germany called Neuland, and they
I think I've heard of them. Yep.
Yeah. So these guys here, I don't know if this is going to show up, right? But they make quite a line. So their initial support was for graphic recorders that I mentioned earlier, who use markers on big boards. So they have a line of markers that are really thick and big and colorful, and they're designed for those users. But they've started developing, it's called the Neuland Outliner and Fine Ones line, which is more of a traditional marker size. They have specifically, the Outliner has this waterproof ink. So when you lay it on the page, you can put color right over it and it won't blend with the color, which is really handy if you need to use color. But what I like about their pens is that they're actually kind of lifetime investments because they can be refilled. You can buy ink and refill them.
Right.
And then if the tip gets mushy, you can actually buy bags of tips and pull the tips out and replace them. So in a sense, you'd buy the pens once and really just up your supplies of ink and brushes and tips and things, and you can just keep them running for a long time. So that's a big advantage for that pen series. So those are the two that I have sort of come to lean on. And then of course I like pencil. I tend to like mechanical pencil because I don't have to have a sharpener. I lean toward a 0.7 mechanical pencil. I just like a little bit thicker line, and I typically do softer lead, so like a 2B or something like that, that's got a little softer lead to it. So when I sketch, it just sort of flows off my hand on the page, and even though it's a little bit smeary and I get some on the back of my hand, it's worth it for the feeling that I get from sketching with pencil that way. So those are sort of my tools of choice.
Oh, fantastic. And I think, you know, having that mess on your hands, that's when you know you've done a good sketch note.
Yeah,
right?
That's sort of an indicator. Yeah.
Awesome. So, no, thank you so much, Mike. And just sort of finishing off, really, I'd love to know your sort of vision for the future of visual thinking, because, you know, you're one of the people that lots of people look up to. So as a movement, when you think about visual thinking, is it going in the direction that you'd hope? So, and do you have any concerns about it? Because I was trying to, again, sort of compare the agile sort of world that I've been working in. And I think as a movement, agile was started with lots of good intentions. But if I think what I'm, you know, in terms of what I'm seeing around me, it's become this commodity product that people think you can just buy off the shelf and you're going to become agile all of a sudden. So really interesting to hear your vision for visual thinking.
Mm. Well, I think visual thinking has gone as well as I could have expected. I was thinking about this the other day when I started. It was really a problem that I was solving for myself, because the notes I took too many notes. I used a pencil to erase mistakes. I had giant notebooks. I would take all these notes and never look at them again. So in a lot of ways, they were only half useful in the moment. but I was, even in the moment, I was so focused on not missing something that I really wasn't listening to what was being said as intently as I could have been. So I really solved the problem for myself by limiting myself to a small notebook and a pen, which moved me to a place of being a lot more aware of what I was capturing. And it suddenly, you know, from my perspective, I had all this free time to do drawing and do lettering and have fun with the pages, and ended up with fewer pages with a lot more relevant information. So that's where it started from. You know, my initial concern, or I guess I don't even know if it was a concern, but when I started sharing it, giving the name sketchnoting and leaving it out there for anyone to use, was just that I hoped that the idea was good enough that it would survive. You know, if you are a follower at all of Seth Godin, one of his early books around 2000, 2001 was The Idea Virus. And he talked about, if an idea is good, it will exist on its own. It will continue, and there won't be much you can do to stop it. And I think that sketchnoting has sort of fulfilled that. And so in a lot of ways, I've left the structure pretty open for interpretation. And I think what I think is great about that is that people come to it and they feel confident that they can adapt it to their own needs. So as an example, I have a friend, Rob DeMio, who's a physicist, who stumbled onto sketchnoting, and he's gone in head first, and he uses it all over the place. He's used it professionally and has really impressed other physicists with the work, and he's actually teaching other physicists. So I could have never imagined that application or the influence that it could be having in that space if I had kept it tightly to my vest and not let anyone use the name or control it in that sense.
Right.
Right. So those are the kind of things that really get me excited. Currently, probably the last 3-4 years, it's been school teachers and school districts that are really fascinated, because a lot of times kids discover it and they bring it to the classroom. And then the teachers realize that the kids are actually more engaged in the work they're doing when they can visualize it. And then they remember more, right? So when they go to test them, they actually have more retention of the ideas. So like from a teacher's perspective, this is like a huge win. It's something that kids want to do. It sort of redirects, in a lot of cases, their desire to doodle, you know, on unrelated topics. It's sort of redirecting them to actually doodle on the topic they're learning. And then it's building retention. So teachers are getting excited. I had no idea, you know, really our target market when we released the first book were user experience and information architect designers in that vein, because that's what I was, and I could understand. And those were the people that were doing it at the time, right?
Yeah.
Now here you go, 10 to 13 years later, now school teachers are picking it up. I'm, you know, before the pandemic, I was traveling probably every quarter or so to go to school districts at the behest of school teachers that bothered their principals or their district directors into having me come and teach them. And so I would come in and teach these concepts and ways to apply it so that teachers could, you know, use it to their advantage to teach, and then the students would feel confident and it would be a win-win. So that's really exciting to see teachers really using it and seeing it as a benefit for their teaching abilities. And there's probably other areas where it's been applied, you know, that I've not covered. Certainly many stories of an attorney friend who sketch notes out his arguments, and he goes into court with a sheet of paper with all his arguments laid out in a certain way. And the other attorneys laugh at him until he beats them in court because he's well prepared, right? So there's just so many different ways it can be applied that had I been really restrictive about it, it would have been hard for people to imagine it being applied in a different way, right? So by leaving it open, by leaving it flexible, it let those people sort of imagine it in their own way and develop ways to express it. So that's been really satisfying. I think probably the future that I see is, and I'm hoping for, is that students, kids, will have sketchnoting or visual thinking in general as skills that they have in their toolbox as students to understand information, because they're getting more information than ever to process. So it's another tool for them to use. So having that taught at a really early age, instead of waiting until you're an adult and learning it in a, you know, a workshop, to have it as a kid and have that as a tool that you can use through your whole life, that's really exciting. And that's what I'm excited about for the future, is making it a pretty standard way of teaching concepts. As far as concerns, I don't have a lot of concerns. I think sometimes the word sketchnoting can be used to mean things that really aren't sketchnoting. So, you know, sometimes I'll see someone who will take clip art and, you know, like a Comic Sans typeface, and I'll do something in Microsoft Word or something that approximates, you know, sort of a sketchnotey thing, but they didn't really sketch anything. And it really wasn't, you know, it's an infographic, it's visual thinking, but it's not really sketchnoting. So that would be the concern, is that, you know, the word gets used, and that's probably a concern similar to Agile, right? Where, you know, Agile can be so general that it's can be nebulous. So can it be applied to things that aren't really Agile? I suppose it could. Or maybe this, you know, it's like you follow the letter of the law and you're like a good Scrum team, but you're like a religious, you know, zealot, and you know, you don't follow the actual spirit of what was intended, right? So that can be a danger too, to get it to where it's so rigid that it's sort of pushes people away from it. I don't see that happening now, but I do see, you know, some confusion here and there about what the term means and how to describe it. So that's something I've been thinking about lately.
Fantastic. No, thank you so much. That was really insightful. And I guess just finally to wrap up, Mike, you know, just in terms of what you're up to, what's next for Mike Rohde? What's on the horizon? Do you have any exciting projects you'd like to share some insights about?
Well, I'm really excited about the Sketchnote Idea book. And Mike and I, my partner on the project, have been kicking around doing some new things like colors and maybe a dot grid. We've been getting feedback from the Kickstarter backers about what they'd like to see. So that's something we've been talking about for a while. And I think we're at some point in the future here, we'll release some new options. I'm really excited about teaching online. I know you invited me on the Visual Jam, and that was really fun. And I've been experimenting a lot with online teaching to see what feels good and what feels right. And ultimately my goal is to offer paid classes. I can do a combination of offline and live events where people can come and learn. And it's much more of a workshop environment, so you'll be following along. And so that's what I'm building toward with all this online teaching, is what feels right? What's, you know, what are people responding to? What's useful for them? Like, it might be fun to do it, but if it doesn't change your life a little bit, then is it really something I want to focus my time on? So it's trying all these different ways of approaching teaching and seeing which ones feel like good ones. Maybe there's more than one that I can experiment with. So that's what I'm excited about, is moving into some online teaching, especially in a situation where we can't be together in person. It sort of forces the question, but it also means there's opportunities there, right? The playing field is leveled out, and there's an opportunity to try some new stuff.
Fantastic. No, I can't wait for that, Mike. I'll be at the front of the learning queue. So as soon as that's launched, you know, I'd love to know more about that. But I just want to thank you so much for your time today, Mike. It's been really insightful. I think, you know, it's actually been really interesting to actually get to know you as opposed to watching you draw, because although we love seeing your sketch notes, I think often we don't hear that other side of you. So it's been really insightful for me. So thank you so much on that. And it was awesome of you to join us for the Visual Jam, which is the meetup you mentioned.
So much fun.
Yeah, no, the feedback has been phenomenal. So again, you know, thank you so much for that. And there's any last words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I would say, if you're beginning sketchnoting, or even if you're a longtime sketchnoter, have grace for yourself. I think so often, especially now under the tense situation we're living in, where we're, you know, everything's in chaos and you're never sure, like, if I go out, will I catch something, right? This tense situation, we've got enough problems weighing down on us that we don't need to weigh down on ourselves. So if you try sketchnoting or you're doing something, like, just have grace for yourself and treat it like an experiment. And if you get it wrong, you just learn from that and move on. Like, don't be so hard on yourself in this work. Just have fun with it.
Oh, what a lovely message to end on. So thank you so much, Mike, once again.
Thanks, Patty. It's so great to be here. I appreciate you offering to have me on.
Thank you.